Hello and welcome to PHP Alive and Kicking, brought to you by PHP Architect, made better by our partners at Honey Badger. More about them later. This podcast explores the developments in PHP and what it's like to earn a living in PHP today. I'm one of your hosts, Mike Page, better known as Mike Page Dev. I'm a developer at PHP Architect. My co-host is a longtime contributor to the magazine and now a fellow team member, Chris Miller.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you. That's not the best reading of the opening I've done, but hey ho. So we have, although this is a pre-recorded podcast, just wanted to let people know, though, we do have a Discord. If you're watching this via the live stream on YouTube when this goes out, please come on over to Discord. Me and Chris will be in there, and our guests might also be there as well if you ever want to ask some questions. That we will be hanging around whilst the stream goes live. We've also got now at PHP Architect, if I can find the right tab, a swag shop. Here we go. So get on down there, have a look at what we've got. Some t-shirts, and this is the new items are being added all the time. One of the most recent ones for us is this ink block elephant there, where we've taken from the cover of one of our magazine episodes. So yeah, do come along. There's some pretty cool t-shirts and other bits and pieces in there. Okay. Is there anything else? Oh, we have a conference next year.
We do.
I'm assuming this is still going to go live in 2025. And we do have a conference. Tech 26 will be in Chicago again. And I do have that open. It's open. Let's just show that website really quick. So do on, come on down. It's a great great conference. I've been a few years. Obviously, I've been there in my capacity of a member of the team. But it's always very welcoming. I found it very helpful. Learns a lot of the great speakers. You'll bump into people that work on PHP in the core. You'll bump into people that have written packages that you probably use every single day. And just have a general chat with them. They're just like normal human beings. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Is your first experience of tech class this year, I should say, 25, yeah. Wasn't it, Chris?
It was, yeah. And honestly, one of the best conferences I've ever been to.
Yeah, it's a lot of
fun. I'll be there in 26 as well.
Yes, you're kind of contracted to be there now.
I mean, it does sort of come with the job.
Exactly. Well, enough about that. Let's move on. And who have we got on this episode today, Chris?
So we have Rob Allen. Rob Allen is an independent API contractor. So, hey, Rob, how you doing?
Hey, folks, how you doing? I'm good. Busy day as usual. And welcome and happy to be on the stream. Good to hear about PHP Tech. I liked that. It's a good conference.
You were there last year.
That's right. That's back in 24.
Yes. I'm trying to remember because lots of things have happened. And yes, I think that's the first time we met was when you were there in 24.
That's so, right. Yes. And I've met Chris before around the UK scene.
Yeah. And, we don't actually live that far away from each other. We're both Midlands, both meet up regularly in Birmingham at different things.
Well, we have a little bit of a joke, me and Chris, that we met for the first time at Tech this year, 25. And in fact, I've been reading his articles for years in the magazine, and I thought he was American until I got introduced to him. And it took me a while to click what was going on. It's like my brain just wasn't computing I mean, I was on a bit of a... this was at the speaker's dinner on the Monday evening, because we take all the speakers out, we do dinner, we have a bit of fun. We went bowling this year. So I didn't bowl, but some of the others did. And I was just trying to mingle and talk. But unfortunately, this year, it's been a bit of a running joke, but I actually got injured on the Sunday as we were doing the setup, and we had to go to urgent care. So I have now experienced what American health system's like. And it wasn't a major thing. I've caught my finger and took quite a big chunk out of the tip of my finger when the speaker fell on it. And we couldn't stop it from bleeding. So we had to go. So yeah, I'm continually...
You do mean audio by... speaker, right?
Yes.
Not a speaker.
No, not a speaker. Yeah, no. I was setting up. Okay. So for people that don't know or might not have heard on some of them, but my background is in sound and lighting in theatres and events. So I tend to get, when I go over, I get thrown in for setting up a lot. Well, we all do. We're all pitching, but I was running around being a bit careless. It was my own fault. I hadn't put my protective gloves on, things like that, and I'd loosened something on the speakers and it just fell onto my finger and I couldn't get my finger out fast enough. So I wasn't feeling at my best on the Monday night when I actually got introduced to Chris and this English accent, and I literally was thinking, but he's American and he's talking to me. I'm going, he's American. What? And I just, it's, my brain didn't click straight away. So we do joke about that. And the fact that we're literally an hour away from each other. So we've gone thousands of miles to meet for the first time. So that's, but I suppose you and me, we can say the same thing. Well, we went all the way over to the States to actually meet for the first time. And so, but we've bumped into each other a few more times since then.
Yeah, it happens. There's quite a lot going on in the UK in terms of PHP and community.
Which is brilliant. Yeah, it's great.
Which is good stuff.
Yeah. So talking about PHP, how did you end up in the world of PHP?
Well, it's a long while ago now. So way back in the last century. If I can say that, it makes it sound really, really long time ago. But obviously, yes, way before the year 2000, 1995-ish, I got headhunted into a PHP role because I was a C++ developer. I was doing stuff with mobile radio testing for mobile phones. And as a side thing, I was a member of an online gaming guild for computer gaming. Mm-hmm. And I wrote the website for the guild. One of the guild members was looking for a web developer. They contacted me and they paid me a very sensible amount of money to hop over from what I was doing to work for them on web stuff. And I learned web and became a web developer and came across PHP remarkably quickly because it was so much better than Perl. And I think ASP was the other major one at the time, and nobody should be tied into a proprietary language that only runs on Microsoft IIS ever. And PHP was a thing, and PHP was good, and I've been with PHP now since then. So,
many
years. Sorry, 95.
I was going to say 95 was the year it was released, so you would have been version one, and that would have made us the same sort of age in the industry. I've been using it since version one. I discovered it when it was used just for his site, and it was like, this is cool. I want to use this. And it's mad to think that 30 years on, it's such a powerful language even now.
Yeah, it's changed very much and has evolved into a really, really good language. But yeah, 99 I started with PHP 3, so I've been doing it since then. Still have a site that I wrote in 99. I think it launched in 99, might have been early 2000, on PHP 3 that's still in production today in PHP 8.4.
I was just about to say, but PHP 3, I want to see that source code.
Let's just say it's the very first app I ever wrote, and that source code will never be released to the public. I learned a lot in that work.
Yes, and the way in which people even just write has changed so much since then that people just don't realize just what PHP is capable of half the time. And I mean, we've alluded to it a few times on our podcast, but you've literally gone from the point of PHP being able to do just websites to now you can write PHP for literally anything. And you can do desktop apps, you can do mobile apps, and it's all the same language. Yes, okay, there's work gone on underneath in other languages to make that possible. But the fact that I could make a mobile app in Laravel if I want to is cool. And it is. Probably will. It's so
yes. But its strengths are still very much web. And I quite like it for that.
Yes, and that will always be its core of what it's for. And it operates differently to compiled languages like C++. And that's one of the strengths of PHP. But it can also be a downfall, depending on what you want to use it for. And I think you and I have given similar comments before on picking the right tool for the right job. I wouldn't want to go and write a website in C++, but I also probably wouldn't want to go and write an operating system in PHP.
Yeah, it wouldn't be my first choice either.
So. Although well, I may try it just to find out what happens. Go on. No, it's fine.
So, one of my clients currently writes a computer game, which is cross-platform, runs from Steam and stuff like that, and that's obviously all C++. The side we're doing is API-based, and that's all in PHP, because you're going to hit the right tool, right job. You're going to be talking to a graphics layer that's in C++, and it's very time-sensitive. The stuff on the servers, that's all PHP.
Yeah, and I suppose that kind of leads nicely into my very next question. What does an API consultant do?
An API consultant writes APIs, designs APIs, answers questions about APIs, basically does everything about APIs because they're absolutely rubbish at doing HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. It's slightly unfair. I have done it before, but I'm not. My strengths do not lie in the presentation side of websites. My strengths lie in the back end. They lie in solving people's problems at the business domain, if we were to use DDD. And in today's age, that tends to be web APIs. Very, very few people are writing monolithic websites nowadays. Mostly because we need to also talk to mobile apps as well as talking to the website itself. So you tended to see APIs tend to be where most of the business logic is ending up. And hence I've gravitated that way. The view layer is JavaScript, or when I started, the view layer was XML. It's my kind of view layer with my kind of interesting job because I like the business problems. So yeah, that's what I do. I help people solve API stuff. It's all variety of different layers. Some of my clients, I literally just answer questions and help their devs do the work. Other clients, I do the actual dev work itself and build them APIs that then they use.
That's cool. So I assume you'll work across the different forms of APIs. So, you know, you might have a JSON API, you might have a SOAP API. And of those, which do you find is probably the easiest to write in PHP?
So you're showing your age a little bit there by mentioning SOAP. We try not to talk about SOAP anymore.
I mean, yeah, but...
However, having said that... I do work in enterprise quite a lot, and SOAP still exists there. I tend to like, for want of a better phrase, RESTful-ish APIs. Most of my clients do not generate pure REST APIs. They are quite challenging to build up to the full rich and maturity model, and most clients don't need that level of rigor, so don't tend to go that way. I've done a few GraphQL APIs in my time. Doesn't happen so often for me. I tend to think GraphQL APIs are more specialist. I think if you're going to build a GraphQL API, you should know why you're building it and the strengths of GraphQL are within the problem set you are trying to solve. If you're not sure whether you should use a GraphQL API or a RESTful API or an RPC API, then the answer is write a RESTful one. Mm-hmm. It is much easier for your clients to access and operate against. They will have experience of it. It's generally more widely available. It's easier in the grand scheme of things. The other two, RPC APIs like SOAP or JSON APIs, JSON RPC is another common one around now, have their place. They're still in use. You still see applications being built for them, but they tend to be written for industries or domains which expect that type of API. Similarly, GraphQL works the same way. If you've got a environment where you're controlling both ends, then GraphQL is really good. If you want to move a lot of the business logic to the client, then GraphQL starts looking interesting. If you're making a generic public API, then you probably want RESTful. Sorry, I appreciate I'm going on quite a lot here. I just continue talking.
That's fine.
And that's exactly why we bring people on. You have expertise that, let's be honest, I don't. And I don't want to speak for Mike, but I'm pretty sure you don't write gRPC APIs and JSON APIs. No?
No.
I did do
quite a bit in my previous role, was mainly APIs. APIs and database development, because I worked the company I worked for built VR and AR applications, which needed to gather data, and they need to be an admin front end as well for people that we're building them for, so they could see what they're collecting data. But that was mainly REST. A few sort of blurry lines here and there where I needed to do something slightly more whatever the app developers wanted. Really. I was the only PHP developer in that company. So that was sort of, I did it how I wanted it. I don't know if it's the best way to do it, but in this role I'm in now, I don't do a lot of, I deal with a lot of APIs and have lots of nightmares with APIs, like APIs that return 200, no matter what the result of it is. That's one of the nightmares we've had to deal with. And they put an error code in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, why is this not working? You're sending me a 200. Oh, because you're sending me like a 400 in the actual body. I've been looking at the proper response code. That's been an interesting one. Or consistency. That's another one. I've dealt with one where they've just set up a different endpoint for something slightly different, but we're expecting the response to come back exactly the same, but it's not. And it's taken us a few days to go, oh, the response coming back differently. Okay. I'm on the other end. I'm consuming APIs quite a bit and having to deal with some of these weird things that some people do with APIs. And that's generally because of knowledge, I suppose.
Yeah, very much so. And longevity of an API is very hard to keep consistent. In the same way, longevity of a website is the same thing. So if you have got a website that's been around a really long time, for instance, the BBC's website, you can find older pages in older styles. And that's no shade on the BBC. A long-lived website, a long-lived application, will show its age in various places. And APIs and the different older endpoints will tend to behave slightly differently to newer ones as the organization has learnt more.
Yeah.
You'd hope they would have better documentation. That is an area that APIs in particular need more focus.
You'd hope they have documentation.
Well, yes.
Full stop. I've had a few that there is no documentation except for an email they send. This is what we're sending back to you.
Okay. Yeah. And that's unfortunate because you tend to be very small scale at that level.
Yeah.
The larger the intended audience, the better the documentation tends to be.
Yeah.
Depending on how fast the API moves. So, no, really, really good example of fantastic documentation would be GitHub's, for instance. GitHub's APIs are very well documented, really well organized, and they update their APIs mm-hmm. intelligently and with intention, which is quite nice. The payment space maybe less so. You tend to see far more moving, far more, it's far more fast moving in the fintech mm. space, and their documentation can sometimes lag what their API has done, and that lack of joined up thinking can be quite frustrating mm. as an integrator.
Well, the thing is that some of that, the advantages there, it's devs building for devs. But when you've got an organization where they all of a sudden think, oh, we need an API, let's just see if someone in the office can try and put something together. They're not naturally developers. They might be into IT. They might be part of the IT support team. That's where things can go a bit awry. I suppose that's where people like you can come in and help and advise.
On the consultancy side, I do that a fair amount. The client comes to me mm. saying, we need an API. Mm. That's a challenge in itself, in terms of, why do you want this API? What's the reason that you need mm. an API? One of my clients, the board had said they needed an API because that seemed to be the industry trend. So you've now got the executive saying we need an API. And then mm. now you've got down to the people who need to deliver for the executive, you know, for the CEO mm. and for the CTO, and they need to build an API. And, well, what sort of an API? You know, what's our audience? What's the problem we're trying to solve? How are we going to monetize this API? How are we going to pay for it? How are we going to do the maintenance? Mm-hmm. All those questions start coming up, and the actual writing of the little bit of code that's going to be your API, it's relatively small in the grand scheme of the entire product.
Mm.
And your example there of no documentation is a good example of that. Like, we need an API, so therefore I've written the code. Now I have an API. No, you don't. You've just got some code. Mm. To have an API, to have a product, to have something that is sustainable and maintainable, you've got documentation. You've got a build process. You've got a way to make changes to it. You've got a way to communicate with your developers, your integrators who are using it.
Mm.
How, what sort of changes you're going to be making to it, or how to accept feedback when it doesn't go right. If you're lucky, you've got monitoring, so that if it goes down, you know before your integrators tell you. And
mm.
that whole caboodle, that whole thing represents an entire product, and an actual mm. deliverable. And the bit that was writing the code, that's this big. It's tiny yep. in the grand scheme of things, which, of course, is why developers are terrible at estimating how long anything takes.
Mm. Yeah, that, I mean, that's a really interesting way to think about it, and to put in, I think a lot of people, when you say API, they are just thinking about the code. They're not thinking about all the other bits that you've just mentioned there. That's really interesting way to think about it, I think.
Yes, and you should be doing the same at all levels of development. So mm. you've got a ticket to add a new feature
mm.
to whatever. So you're adding your new feature. You've now got to write documentation for your new feature. You need your test for your new feature. You need the plan for getting it into staging and production for that new feature, maintenance for that new feature, communicating to the outside world the new feature exists.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is part of getting that ticket complete. But of course, the developer doesn't see any of that, or chooses not to see most of that, depending on the size of the organization.
Some of it's
not your problem. Like, marketing are going to write the blog post, not you, so mm-hmm. to speak. But someone needs to tell marketing what the new features does.
Yeah.
Sometimes as well, you can be sitting with clients and you can hear this conversation of, we need this and we need that and we need the other, and you're sitting there going, no, you really don't. I remember a time where I was sitting there with a client for a company I was working with through this 3-hour meeting where they explained to me that this, they needed to do this in code and then this in code and then this in code. It was like 20 odd steps that was ending up as this really complex mathematical formula, and it had to apply certain rules at different points. And I listened to this entire explanation of it, and at the end I said, or you could take the first number and multiply it by 0.03 something. And they went, no. So they tested it. And they went away and said, this is close enough for us to go, yeah, we might actually be able to do that. So that 3-hour meeting could have resulted in me being the bad developer and taking 20 grand off them to develop the feature they wanted, or the good developer and going, or I could just simplify your steps to one. And by having that conversation, sometimes as a developer, the best code you have is the one that you didn't write in the first place.
This is true. I mean, you're hitting the difference between different levels of developers as well at this point. Mm. So as you go up the experience tree, for want of a better way of phrasing it, as you become a senior developer into team lead, into architect, into those sort of roles, communication becomes your most vital skill. So as a junior developer, it's all about learning how to code and being a good coder. Mid-level developer. Now you're really, really good at taking a problem and solving it.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you get up to senior, get into architect level, you're now more interested in the problem than the implementation, and getting the right implementation, the right solution for the problem starts becoming more interesting,
mm.
which is why you tend to see the best senior developers are the best communicators. Mm. It's fairly rare to have a really good senior developer who's well respected and does a really good job but can't also communicate well.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I think that puts us as a very convenient point to hear from our sponsors.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Let me tell you a quick story about our sponsor, honeybadger.io. One time, a customer of theirs had a background job run overnight that caused hundreds of thousands of errors to be reported to HoneyBadger by mistake. Like many other error tracking and performance monitoring tools, HoneyBadger bills for monthly usage, and so this customer's mistake was going to cost them a lot of extra money that month. If you've ever used a monitoring service, you might have experienced something like this. Well, fortunately for this customer, they emailed HoneyBadger's support and received the most amazing reply. HoneyBadger was resetting their monthly quota and canceling their bill. This is just one example of how much the small team at HoneyBadger cares about their users. Ask anyone you know and you'll hear similar stories. Go check them out at honeybadger.io. It's free to get started and setup takes less than 5 minutes. Don't forget to bookmark it. That's www.honeybadger.io.
Thank you, HoneyBadger.
So, we appear to have found an echo. Do we still have an echo? We do not. There we go. And this is proof that we record these live. So, I guess the next sort of question I have is around building APIs. How would you approach that with PHP? What's your process of going through building an API these days?
Well, there's a question in itself. The with PHP bit is quite interesting because most of the work is doesn't really matter what the language is. So generally, we're concerned about what the shape of our request and our response will be. By far, that's the most important thing. What the shape of the API is going to look like, how usable is it? What the requirements for it is. Go break it down into different sections, into different grouped sets of endpoints, because your fundamental unit is the unit of the endpoint. In the same way as a web page, you know, your fundamental unit is a web page. But we're going to group our web pages into sections. There's going to be the news section, there's going to be the store section, there's going to be the press releases section or whatever. Same logic in your API. We've got our user management section. We've got our section that does the work, or whatever it might be. So I normally think mostly about the design and how we're going to do that bit. So seemingly we're talking about RESTful. So we're going to be talking about what operations are going to be GET requests, which are going to be modification requests. Are they going to be POST? Are they going to be PATCH? Or are they going to be PUT or DELETE? All that sort of decisions start getting made. In an ideal world, and one of the nice things about me being able to talk to you is that I'm going to pretend it's an ideal world. In an ideal world, we'll write this down first, because mm-hmm. it's so much quicker than trying to...
You mean you want to plan?
I know, I like planning. Agile is wonderful, but planning helps. Ideally, we do all that design. If we're doing vaguely RESTful things, we're probably going to write it all down in something that looks like OpenAPI. That's a nice specification format for describing APIs, endpoints, payloads, how they all fit together. And it generates documentation. So you write in a YAML format or something like that, and you're going to get an HTML format out. The only thing about HTML format is that people who don't understand code can read it, so they can think about it. So hopefully we can spot the inconsistencies early, you know, where we've used pluralization over here, but we've used single over there. Spotting things like that is much easier at the spec stage than it is at the implementation stage. It's certainly less tedious to fix it at the spec stage. So we're going to do something like that, and now we've got some sort of document. Now we need to implement it. You build a new project. If you're building a new project, then you've now got the other architectural decisions to make. Are we building this as a microservice architecture? Is this going to be a monolith? How big's the team working on it? What are the deliverables, in which order? Those sort of questions come up. 9 times out of 10, the right answer is some sort of monolith. Because once you start hitting microservices, you end up with a whole load of other challenges, which are super interesting to solve and might not actually be problems you have. So I think you should be quite careful about going to a full microservices architecture unless you have experience of doing so, because it does introduce additional challenges. The monolith has less of those challenges. Challenges anyway, but less of them. And then you need to build your PHP bit, and that's the easy bit. Pick your language, pick your framework, pick your ORM, write some code. You can tell I'm not particularly interested in that bit. It doesn't really matter to me.
I think that is actually part of what makes it so interesting working with APIs in any language, that 99% of the problem happens before you write the first line of code. And the code is almost secondary, in that, let's be honest, there are systems now where you can plug in an open API spec, and if it is literally CRUD, it can do it for you. You don't need to write code.
For the Greenfield site, at least.
Okay. Yeah. I wouldn't suggest adding that to an existing API, for example, but you have systems now that can do the hard work, but the easy work almost of the code, the hard work is getting that design right. And I think for things like Laravel, like Cake, there are predefined systems that they come up with of how they expect you to do it. Do you ever find yourself fighting against a framework and wanting to go to an alternative?
No. Right. The first rule is, once you've got a framework, you do it the framework way. Right. If you're writing the framework, then you're doing it wrong. So if you're going to use Laravel, then do it the way Laravel expects it to work. It's a fool's errand not to. And because I'm a consultant, I tend to work in the technologies that my clients prefer. So if I've got a team of experienced Laravel developers writing an application that doesn't work the way Laravel works, is not setting them up for success. So we don't do that. It's just no point. We're there to make a successful product. We're there to make a product that could be maintained for the long term. If we're using Laravel, because we're using that as an example at the moment, then we want it to be written such a way that when the next version of Laravel comes out, we could use Laravel Shift to do the upgrade. We don't want to have done something so weird that Laravel Shift doesn't work anymore. That would be a nonsense. If we're not doing that, then we're picking a different framework. So we're using Symfony framework, or say we're using API platform, then we're going to follow the API platform's paradigms and its conventions, because that will work out the best for within that set of code. If we've got very specific requirements for the way we want to develop it, because, I don't know, maybe we're not using a database behind the scenes, for instance, or maybe we're not outputting JSON, our output format is different. Those sort of scenarios, you start wanting to go down to a more component-based solution. So you start looking at something like Mesier or something like Slim Framework, because you're already doing something quite specialist anyway, and you're probably writing or benefiting less from the ecosystem stuff. Relatively speaking, there's few of those. 99% of everything we do fundamentally could be done with WordPress at the end of the day. 99% of all websites are just content.
But, yep.
Or they're a web shop, in which case we can do it with Shopify. But back in what we're mostly doing, though, they're all specialist stuff. When we start doing specialist stuff, we need a framework of some form or another. Picking one of the bigger frameworks is generally easier in terms of the knowledge within your team already. Going with the team's knowledge is generally better, certainly as a consultant. And then, yeah, follow it as best you can to the way that that framework works is the way I would try to do it. Occasionally, you want to do a few bits that are different. The most obvious ones are related to output formats. So one of the misconceptions about APIs is that the output format is just JSON, therefore it doesn't really need to be thought about. That's not a good move. It's a view layer in the same way that HTML is a view layer for a web page. And all the good frameworks have transformation or transformer type classes to enable you to choose how the output looks and format it appropriately and independently of your database. So Criteo is all well and good, but it doesn't take very long before you need to decouple your database architecture from your API output layer. So putting that in first is super helpful. And that's where you start getting some of the specialist stuff happening. Mm-hmm. If you don't control the output because it needs to be a standard standardized to a way that is not normal because of where you're sending it, is where things get interesting. In a Chinese kind of way.
Yeah, it's interesting that you call it a view layer, which it is. And CakePHP is the only framework I've known that literally uses the view layer to do it, to reinforce that point. And you edit an API in Cake using their format, literally in template files, which...
Right.
It's a fascinating way of doing it, but it forces that thought process that there's a user at the end of this. You're not just downloading some text. And even down to formatting of how many spaces there are in the JSON. Yes, we can probably argue over that forever, and then we can argue over whether it's spaces or tabs. And there's a lot that goes into the thinking of how it's output. And you look at the huge companies like, people like Stripe or Vonage, and you'll see how things have evolved over time. And as you were saying earlier, you've got those slight differences from the older ones to the newer endpoints and how they're slightly different. And it's fascinating to think that we haven't yet, as far as I can tell, come up with a solution that solves this long term. Have you found any ways of handling legacy that needs updating?
Right, so the terminology, if you go search for it, is probably transformer. So I think Cake must be very unique in sort of actually calling it the view layer, which is quite a nice way of doing it. But we can always use a programmatic transformation layer to go from wherever our internal representation of our domain is to our output format. The nice thing about doing it as a programmatic class or process of some form or another is that handling versions is easier. Because you talk about legacy, the next obvious thing that comes up is having to handle the fact that we need a new version of the output. So, and we talk about versions of APIs. Generally, when we are changing the version of an API, we are changing it because we want to alter the list of properties that are in the output, or we want to rename the properties that are on the request. So we're creating a backwards incompatible change. So classic example, you've got some sort of user endpoint retrieves you a user item, and in that user item there is an address property. And inside that address property, it's an object that's got street, town, postcode, country, or whatever. And the business have come along and said, oh, we need multiple addresses. So that needs to be an array. And we can't make an address an array, not without breaking all the clients that expect it to be an address object.
Mm.
So now we've got BC break. How do we handle that BC break? That's the question. And at that point, the challenge in the code is not breaking the old way when you write the new way.
Mm. Yep.
It's dead easy to write the new way. It's really hard to keep the old way working. And your most profitable customer is using the old way. So you can't break the old way because that's where the company makes all their money, because the profitable customer's on the old way. And we're trying to persuade the profitable customer to go to the new way. But the profitable customer's got other things that they care about. They don't care about us. 9 times out of 10.
Mm.
Ergo, we need to keep V1 working. And that is one of the hardest challenges in the average API development cycle. Transformers are quite a good way of doing this at one level, because that solves your view layer problem. Because now we can just write a V2 transformer. And however we're managing our API versioning, whether we're using the media type on the accept header, or whether we're using a V1, V2 on the URL path, we can switch on that, pick the correct transformer class, and do the work. That's super helpful to think about it like that. It's also helpful to put that in at the beginning, but it's not that hard to retrofit, which is nice. It's when you start making domain level changes that it gets complicated. When the operation of calculating the way that you do a total is you're doing a different algorithm. So go back to your example of the point multiplied by 0.13 or 136 or whatever. So maybe in version one, we're multiplying by 0.136 and sending that out as the value in our API. Version two comes along and we now need the high precision solution. So we implement the high precision solution, and now we're sending out the new the total's now got the right number in it. But all our clients were expecting the approximate value. So that's that is a BC break. Possibly. Mm-hmm. Might not be, but possibly. Let's assume it is. So now you've got two versions of your business logic you need to maintain, even though your output layer is the same.
Yes.
So this is where the complexities arise. The complexities invariably arise around things like that. And you don't see these problems until you've got a long-lived application, which it tends to be a legacy application, because it's only legacy applications that are making money that hence are still around. And they tend to be crufty code, because once you get to the point where it's worth making those sort of changes, you tend to be in a situation where the app's been around a while. So it's gone through three versions of Symfony, and it's gone through multiple different database migrations. And now you need to worry about this sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's a challenge, and it's a maintenance challenge, but it's the area that I find most interesting.
Yeah, I can see why. But those are the sort of areas I like as well. How do you solve this problem? And there's 20 different patterns you can use to solve the problem, but it basically boils down to you need to make a choice based on that versioning ID, however you get that version ID in there. I mean, we could do an entire podcast on the ways to version an API. And
we could, but not with me, because I don't care. of all the things I really don't care about, right? API version is one of them. I care that you don't break your backwards compatibility promise. That's all I care about. Mm-hmm. Whether you put it in the URL, whether you put it as a subdomain, whether you use a media type, it's not a difficult. It's not a problem for me. Not breaking your output and not changing your version, that irritates me, because that is a pain as an integrator. You're the one who's dealing with it as a client. That is a horrible job to have to deal with.
Yep. I like the ones that don't tell you that they're going to change something, and you find out the following morning when there's a million errors.
So, oh, yeah. I have a story on that one.
That's a challenge in itself, though, because how do you communicate it? Mm. How would you communicate that you are retiring an API? How would you do that? That is one of the hardest problems there is.
I consume an API for a personal app, and it just hits this one endpoint once a month, collects all the data, sticks it in my database. And one month, I wake up to, funny enough, a honey badger alert to say that it's not checked in. That job's not checked in. I'm like, well, okay, what's going on? Have a look. Everything should be fine. They changed the URL.
Yes.
I don't know when they did it. It was sometime between the start of the month before and then, but they changed the URL. I'm like, what's going on? But I couldn't find anywhere, any documentation, anything to say that they were changing it. And then I think they did put something, I think they put something in the documentation, but unless you're looking at the documentation every day, you're not going to know.
And but that also, is the fundamental problem.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, they don't know that I'm using their API. How do they inform me? Unless I'm signing up to a newsletter or consuming, looking for extra inputs in the body to say, by the way, making these changes. How do you know when those sorts of changes are happening?
This is a difficult problem. Mm. If you've got API registration, so every key is authorized. Every endpoint is authorized. So you've got some sort of token involved somewhere. Then you at least have some sort of relationship with the client or the integrator. Mm-hmm. Getting them to care that you're changing something is a problem in itself. Like, it's not uncommon for a team to build a given integration against an API and then move on to something else. And then that thing is given to the end customer. The end customer uses it for 5 years and never, ever thinks about it. So that's not uncommon. This is why you see the big companies do things like brownouts, where they will randomly reduce or remove access to the API endpoint they're going to remove and let it error and then bring it back up again. So the error message that goes back down the wire has got, we are removing this endpoint in 2026. Make sure you migrate to our new one. Here's a URL to go to. That's the error message you send back down to on that endpoint. You turn it off for an hour. All the API clients that hit it get the error message. If they try again in an hour, it works as usual, but now they've got something in their logs that gives them a message. But now you need someone to actually go and read the log. You know, if you've got registration, you can send them an email. If the email they signed up with and got their token or their key is still the email they're using, you can put it on your blog.
They've got to go to the blog and see that.
Yep.
And in my instance, there's no key. It's just, you just send the request and you get the response. There's nothing, no authorization or anything like that. There's no real way to have informed us that there was going to be a change.
Yes, at which point you have to fix it when it breaks.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why I quite like the people who do the controlled timeouts. Because if that happened, you'd have found, it doesn't work. I've now got to go and look up why it's not working. But tomorrow, your API would have worked as normal until you got around to fixing it properly. Now, that part is called API life cycle. Because the API life cycle starts from, we need an API, which is where we started right back at the beginning of this conversation, all the way through to how do we turn an API off? Life cycle implies a finish. How we turn an API off is equally as important for planning as getting started on the API. But of course, developers like us, we don't care about that so much. But the business people should be caring about that quite a lot. Assuming they're making money off it. If they're not making money, then all bets are off.
But it's interesting you should say that only this week I've actually had an email from the Met Office to tell me that they're expiring one of their APIs. And I thought, how quick's this going to expire? 2027. I'd say that's fairly good notice because now I've got time to do something about it. I've also had the reverse previously where it's, by the way, we retired this yesterday. Right, thanks. they insist that they sent me others. They didn't. I've checked the emails. And it's interesting how different companies will handle it, and some companies just don't tell you. Or, as you've said, may not even have a way of telling you.
Yeah, and you start hitting Conway's law, of course, in that all this affects the way that the company is internally as to how well they're going to handle it externally.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, I don't know about you, Mike, but I found this a very interesting conversation.
It has been. It certainly has been. I'm quite interested to understand. I'm sure there are other people like to sort of ask about. Now, you said it before we came on there not to use the word freelance. That's not what you are. or a contractor. You're an advisor. How did you get started in that? How do you... Do you market yourself, or are you mainly getting your clients through word of mouth these days? And how would you start off if you were to start today and to do what you do now? How does that look?
There's a question. Yeah, so I call myself an independent API consultant because from my point of view, you are purchasing my brain, not my hands. So the key thing from my point of view is that my knowledge is way more interesting than the fact that I output some code for you sometimes. Freelancers, not as much freelancers, but contractors tend to join teams and tend to work under the direction of that team for the development. And that's a perfectly great way to earn a living and do lots of interesting projects. They tend to be one project at a time, though. I tend to work with multiple clients simultaneously. So I've got three or four clients and their projects go in simultaneously in each week. So it's a different type of job in that sense. How you get into it? I wish I knew. that would be a super helpful thing for careers, wouldn't it?
So, yeah.
How to get new clients is another one that I wish I knew how that worked, because then I'd have more of them. I was a standard web developer. Most of my time I worked at a web agency. The web agency was struggling and I was doing some work on the side. I was relatively underpaid, which motivated me to do some work on the side. The work on the side started growing to this point where it looked possible that it could replace my day job. And that's the point I quit my day job and went self-employed, because I've built up a bit of a business simultaneously. Now, that is really easy for me to say that in my very privileged position of being married with a partner at home who is able to run my household whilst I'm working in the evenings on plant projects. Not everyone has that way to get into a second career, if you see what I mean. So I appreciate that I was very fortunate in being able to do that. I think it's very difficult to become self-employed without the knowledge and experience of having done lots of work. So I think if I was newly starting out, I think working for a variety of companies, doing a variety of different industries is actually quite good for a career. I think that's quite helpful to have ideally experience different types of teams and different types of, let's call it project management for now, or project mismanagement might be more accurate half the time. but the way companies and teams operate is something you need to understand if you're going to join one and be good and be part of it. And if you're going to advise a company on how to do things, you need to come from a relative position of authority. So you need to have built up that authority somehow first. And obviously the grey beard helps in providing the proof that I've been around a long while now. You need to have got that experience. That experience is easier to get within a traditional career structure, is, I think. I could be wrong about that, but I think that works. Finding new clients, for me, it's nearly all word of mouth. It's all via being known, which is a challenge in itself. How do you get known in order for people to recommend you? How do you market in a way that people can find you? Because my clients are not necessarily developers, they are people who need developers. But my word of mouth works in that developers have heard of me and they recommend me to their CTOs and to their CEOs. And that's how I get work. And that's why I speak at conferences. That's why I've written for PHP Architect in the past. They're ways to get my name known amongst developers at some level or another, and sometimes it magically turns into a client who wants some work done. I'm sure there are better ways of marketing, but I start hitting the traditional developer problem of not being an extreme extrovert, like the average salesman appears to be. So that bit is slightly harder for me in that sense.
But I see it's kind of a trend in what you're saying is something I advocate, and we've talked on a couple of the other episodes, is about being part of the community, being out there, and you never know what happens. I mean, at the end of the day, if people have seen the first episode where both me and Chris talked about how we got to where we are today, it was about being in the community in different various ways. Obviously, Chris has been writing for the magazine for a long time, and his name is well known. He's always in the Discord at PHP Architect, sort of helping people out all the time, and that's kind of where he got in and talking to Eric and John, knew of him. I was fairly similar, being involved in the community. Sort of got that profile up, and when I said that I was needing to find work, they reached out, and that's kind of how it all happened. So I see it's very, and I think Eric and John talk about the conferences, how many people that have gone to conferences and have made relationships, and now careers have changed because of being in those conferences. I think that's important. I get the fact that it's difficult for people that aren't that outgoing. I'm one of those people, as you know. Well, we've talked about this a few times, that I'm not very, it's very hard for me to talk to people and start the conversation. That generally I need someone to either introduce me or to start the conversation with me. And that's one of the more personal reasons why I'm doing this podcast, this show, is to try and force myself out of my comfort zone a bit. And you'll be pleased to know I have submitted talks to Tech26.
Excellent.
So I might actually be talking. Whether I'll be talking any sense to anyone, I don't know. It might be a load of rubbish. But you can blame Chris as well, because he's the one that sort of twisted my arm and said, no, just do it.
Good.
So they are, whether they get picked, I don't know. They might not get picked. There's still a selection process to go through, but you never know. I might actually be talking, but
community is a very nice way to talk about it. If we're going to talk about it more professionally, we would use the word networking. But community is a much more friendly way to be thinking about it, because it's less intimidating than networking. So I'm in the community, I don't network. In that sense, because I don't think I could cope with that level of intimidation. And there's nothing more important for your career, even if you're going to be a full-time developer working for a big corporate the entire career. Your chances of getting better jobs in the companies you want to work for significantly increase if you have been networking so that you know people. Mm-hmm. And how you do that networking is up to you, but community, in-person stuff, even though a lot of us are now quite remote, does make quite a big difference, in my opinion. At least I found it valuable over my career.
I would completely agree. And I mean, although I had never met Eric and John face-to-face, it was all, our communication was all through the Discord. And even then, it wasn't that much of a technical sort of involvement I had. I mean, I asked a lot of questions, I'll admit. And for people who might not have known, I'm very new into this industry. I've only been developing for about 5 years now, so I feel myself a very still like baby compared to, especially present company at the moment. You guys have been in, I'm not talking about the grayness, I'm talking about the years you've been in the industry. I've just come to it at a very late age. Go back to the first episode and you can hear about that. I won't reiterate here. Most of my interactions was actually setting up a chess club for people in the Discord to play chess against. I sort of helped John and Eric and gave them some tips about chess. And even though I'm not a massive, really good chess player, I'm sort of a low club level chess player, but that was a main interaction. So my kind of message is, you don't have to know a lot of stuff about PHP or programming in any form. Just join in any way. just have a chat, say hi to people, ask questions, answer them if you can. I still think I've yet to find a question that I can actually answer. or normally someone's answered it before I actually get to it, because a lot of the community that we're in Maine is based in the US, so by the time we get up, someone's already answered someone's question, so we don't see it a lot. But although we do have quite a few Europeans in the chat as well, but just get involved is a really strong message. It's just get involved, and it doesn't, I know you said face to face, it doesn't always have to be face to face if that's really intimidating. Join online networks is invaluable, I think, and I've echo everything you've said there. And talking about sort of building up the courage to talk is another thing that a lot of people have said to me, and I'm sure both of you would agree. People in the audience want you to succeed. They don't want you to fail, so they'll be cheering you on no matter what you talk about. I could stand up and talk about my dogs for 50 minutes. They don't care. They care that I'm up there saying something. So that's a slight comfort. It's only a slight comfort. I am still absolutely bricking doing these talks. They're not technical talks, the ones I've put forward, but I won't spoil anything yet. No spoilers yet, but we'll see. And you yourself, Robert, have been a big part of me taking that step, because we've had that conversation every time we've met about taking those steps, and it's just taken me a little while. I'm getting there.
Yeah, a lot of it's down to what you want to do as well. Like, you don't have to speak. You don't have to be a proactive member of a community.
Mm.
But in my experience, at least, the benefits of being part of a community, part of a group of some form or another, has vastly improved my career.
Mm.
I'm a much better developer than I ever would have been if I hadn't had the community of people helping me and cheering me on all the way back to when I started on a mailing list talking about C++. Mm. That literally knew nothing, and the people on there were answering my questions, and then eventually I became one of the people replying with an answer because someone had told me the answer 2 years previously. And then I started actually understanding why that was the answer, which is even more impressive.
Yeah.
But that level of community, that level of interaction with your peers, vastly improves your career.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Mm-hmm. I think that gives us a very good point on which to end.
Yeah, we're slightly running longer than we would normally, but yeah.
I did warn you.
We'll have to have you on again.
Yeah,
we'll have you on again, and we'll talk something else.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll pick your brains about other things. But yeah, well, thank you very much for giving up your time to speak to us today. It's been really interesting. Really enjoyed having the chat with you. Hope we all bump into each other in person at some point,
or just cough down, we will.
Or just arrange to meet. We're all so close to each other. Yeah, it's not like we're on the other side of the world. We're all quite close. So, yes. Well, thank you very much, Rob, for joining us today. And thank you very much, everyone, for watching. And we'll see you in the next one.
You're welcome. Bye.